Hey everybody, it is time. It is time to hop on a plane, a train, a boat, a goat, a bike, a car, and find your way upstate New York to a little town outside of Phoenicia. I don't know what the town's called actually, but the place that we're going to be in is called Menla, and it is a gorgeous, epic retreat center in the middle of the forest in the Catskill Mountains with a spa and organic vegetarian food with lots of beans and yoga in the morning and a swimming pool and a swimming hole and trails. And yes, it is an HLN retreat. It is a 5-day retreat from Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. It is the biggest retreat we've ever put on, and the entire team is going to be there. They are all flying from different corners of the country to come together to hold you in the healing magic that is somatics. We will be teaching you how to belong without having to fit in, how to find safety inside of yourself and share that with others, how to receive witnessing, how to feel for your boundaries instead of fawning. We are going to cover so much, and you're going to be doing it in the most ideal setting of being fed, of being loved, of resting, of enjoying the forest and nature, and being with us and 60 other bodies. So please go to the website, holisticlifenavigation.com, and click on events, and you'll find it there. Wednesday, June 12th to Sunday, June 16th. All the info as well can be found directly through the link in this episode details. I am just so thrilled for this, and I can't wait to see some of you in person. Today I am joined by my friend Chelsea Goodwin and her wife, Dr. Rusty Mae Moore.
And then I was at the point of I might as well try, because the only alternative I have left is to off myself because I can't go any further on the path that I'm on.
Welcome to the Holistic Life Navigation Podcast. I am your host, Luis Mujica. I was sick and depressed until I discovered that I could make music, and then my whole life transformed because I began learning how to listen more deeply. Listen to life, to the people around me, and to my body. And that's when I realized that the body speaks through sensations, and learning this new language meant relearning my body and mind. I soon healed myself of many chronic conditions and then began teaching others how to do so as well. Holistic Life Navigation combines nutrition, self-inquiry, and somatic experiencing to help you release stress and trauma just by listening to your own body. This podcast serves as a place to share my experiences, as well as the experiences of many others who have healed and are healing through unique, unorthodox, and unusual ways. Your time to learn begins now. Chelsea Goodwin and her wife, Dr. Rusty Mae Moore. They are both very notable in the LGBTQI movement for founding the Transy House in Park Slope, Brooklyn in 1995, where they could provide shelter and safe space for transgender and gender nonconforming peoples who were kicked out of their homes simply for being who they were. And because of that, they were unable to continue high school or college and were denied safe space in women's shelters and men's shelters due to their ambiguous and controversial gender identities. So Transy House became a place where they could all meet, live, and take care of themselves in a safe, coexisting, cohabitating environment. Transy House operated for 13 years, closing in 2008.
Now, you're going to notice there's a slight shift in sound quality, and that's because, as Chelsea said in the interview before we started, we have become victims of Mercury retrograde. What that means is Mercury is retrograding, and technology and communication tend to go awry when that happens. So my microphone broke, and took me 3 different times to find Chelsea and meet with her and Rusty. So just want to say that this interview essentially is really Chelsea and Rusty talking about their story. It's not an interview like I normally do that's specific to trauma healing. But if you listen and you feel and you take in the information, you do hear a story about resilience and somehow loving yourself when no one else can or does. And these two women created safe space for many, many, many women, including Sylvia Rivera, which was once called the Rosa Parks of the transgender movement, because she worked so hard to try to get the lesbian and gay community to accept transgendered women and transgendered men. And she worked really hard as well on the equal rights for people of color. She was a force, and they gave her a safe space when she was living on the streets. She was literally living on the West Side Pier. And I think they probably saved her from death and let her go on to do really beautiful work for quite some time before she passed, I believe, in 2002 from liver failure. So enjoy this. It's unique and unusual and beautiful, just like Chelsea and Rusty are. And it's a glimpse into the history of the queer movement, which, or to be more specific, a history into the transgender movement and some of the people who were the building blocks of that to pave the way for a lot of us to become accepted. Not just transgenders or queers, but, you know, to me, a queer is just anyone who is the other, who doesn't quite fit into a category. And I'm always inspired by people who are way before their time and just doing what feels authentic and right for them. And Rusty and Chelsea are the epitome of authentic. So I hope you enjoy. First, I just want to welcome you and thank you both for being here. And we'll kind of go back and forth, you know, between both of you. So I want to hear how both of you think. I'm very curious about that. And so the very first question I have for you is just to share with us what life was like before you came out and during when you did, because you came out before it was trending. And so I want to start with Rusty and then go to Chelsea. And I want to know, what was that like for you? What was your experience?
Well, I'm trying to think when I came out. It must have been around when I was, you know, 10 to 12 years old and then on, you know. And I didn't really ever have really much trouble coming out. I mean, people were not beating me up and stuff like that, and people seemed to be accepting of having me involved in their community or involved in their organization or whatever that was. So it was relatively, so far, it's been relatively easy to go through the transition and to continue with the transition. I don't know whether I pass as a woman or not, but I think I do have an easy time in getting through.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. When did you begin your transition, and when did you begin publicly transitioning?
I think it was, you know, when it was.
You didn't really transition as far as at your job and with your kids and everything until about 1991, by which time you'd already been living with me, and I was out at the time, but you also got to use me as your spear catcher. Anything thrown at you, you could see what happened to me before you took a chance. You know, in the Western, you know, in the old Western, Sal, they'd put the cowboy hat on top of a stick and hold it up to see if the Indians were still shooting.
You were the cowboy hat.
She used me for that hat. Yeah.
That's love. That's real love. So that's so beautiful to hear though, Rusty, that it was just, so far it's been easy for you and accepted. It's gorgeous. It's not everyone's experience, obviously. That's really nice. What about you, Chelsea? What was your journey like with that?
I came out in the early 1980s in Phillipsburg, New Jersey, and I thought that I knew what hatred was, being a nerd in school. I thought I knew what hatred was, being a hippie in a conservative, disgusting hellhole in Western New Jersey. But I never realized that being run out of town was a real thing that actually happens until I was literally run out of town. On the other hand, things weren't easy in New York City in the mid-1980s, but that was a hell of a lot better than a hellhole in Western New Jersey. And
so you were literally run out of town.
Yes.
Amazing.
The reasons are different, but if you want to know what my life at the time I came out was like, I would refer you to a song written by the great Cuban-American philosopher Aurelio Voltaire, Raised by Bats.
Mm.
I would also refer you to his Hate Lives in a Small Town.
So you get, those are autobiographical.
Those two songs pretty much, all his songs about how horrible New Jersey is, I live them.
Amazing. And what gave you the inspiration and the courage to come out in a town where there was no support?
Looking back on it, I had been married. I was already married. We had already had a son who was in his first couple of years of life. And I had a complete and total breakdown until I was I snapped.
Sure.
I couldn't survive anymore. I couldn't function anymore. I had snapped, and the person I was not the person I was trying to be, the persona I had created, that person could no longer function. I just couldn't keep it together anymore.
Were you consciously living as a transgendered person that was not out yet? Is that what you meant? There were these two parts that were competing?
No.
You just felt something was off?
Well, it all fell into place suddenly that was a path that I always thought I should be on, and I thought it was so unachievable, I never thought of trying. And then I was at the point of, I might as well try, because the only alternative I have left is to off myself, because I can't go any further on the path that I'm on.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was just no longer a possible thing for me to continue on the path I was on.
Yeah, I completely get that.
It was just over, and I don't know.
It was easier for you. I shouldn't say easier, but it was an option for you to be hated, run out of your town, live in a very, you know, violent part of the city, but being authentic versus having a safe life and hiding.
Exactly.
Yeah, although, I really respect that.
Although I really hadn't really fully expected the angry mob with the pitchforks and the torches like something from a Universal horror movie, but it wasn't very far from that.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Do you remember Elvira, Mistress of the Dark?
I do, actually. I remember the car wash scene.
Remember when they play the song Town Without Pity and they are getting ready to literally burn her at the stake? I lived that for real.
You were Elvira.
That's literally what it was like.
Yeah, that's amazing. And was it painful for you? Like, was it difficult for you? Did it not bother you? How did you deal with it?
Well, let's see. I was scared absolutely shitless. Mm. Who wouldn't be?
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked because I knew things were bad, but I didn't know they were that bad. As a matter of fact, I sometimes think a few years earlier, before Reagan came to power, it might have been easier because there was a part of the 70s where things were loosening up.
Right.
And then Reagan came in and it all started to clamp down hard again. And I mean, everything from Reagan onward, and not just with the Republicans, was about taking that genie that came out of the bottle in the 1960s and early 70s with the counterculture and trying to stuff it into the back into the bottle. And of course, such a thing cannot really be done, but the amount of pain and suffering and horror that they wrought upon the earth trying is unimaginable.
So interesting. It's like really like when you say that genie in the bottle and try to and put it back in.
And the historical parallels.
Well, Reagan, that's right.
Reagan would let dead bodies pile up in the streets from AIDS and not do anything but blame the victim, the way Trump is content to let dead bodies pile up in the streets from COVID and not do anything except tell people not to wear their masks, not to listen to their doctors, and to die faster.
Well, I'm curious then for Rusty, when you came out in the 90s when you were already in the city living with Chelsea. Mm-hmm. So what was life for you like before coming out? Did you know this part of your true self and you were just repressing it for a bit?
Well, I was separated from my wife and family. My kids went and lived with my ex-spouse, who I was still in good relations with her and spent time with her, whatever, spent a lot of time with the kids. So it was pretty easy. I mean, I never had any trouble in terms of people attacking me or anything like that, or saying weird comments about me. What, you know, I just sort of eased through that phase of my life.
Mm.
I guess I'm still doing that.
Mm. It's beautiful. Yeah, I mean, I never would have thought you were a trans woman. So to me, you're very authentic and very graceful, very beautiful, and you come off very just exactly who you are. Truthfully.
Well, that's such a nice thing you say. It makes me feel good.
Yeah, it makes me so happy that you had Chelsea to, I mean, be that backbone in that way, where someone, Chelsea's a powerful bitch.
Chelsea would give me tips on things. And,
yeah, that's who I'd want to be with if I was going through something.
It was like a good thing. I learned a lot from Chelsea.
Mm. Rusty had the advantages of being a college professor at Hofstra with tenure, and to no surprise to me, but surprising to her, when she came out, they bent over backwards to be supportive in any way possible because, you know, they were liberal academics.
Mm. Well, then, my question then for you is the. You know, what made me want to reach out, because I've known you for years, we've been friends, I've talked to you, you're usually interviewing me, and I thought, well, this would be fun to interview you two, because you're both so humble, you have this rich history with activism.
I feel really, really proud to have Louis Malika call me a friend, I really do.
To call you a friend, oh, come on. But so it's just so interesting.
Come on, but you are a bit of a rock star. On a level that I never reached, and don't think I didn't try.
You're a rock star in my eyes. When I saw the documentary, The Life and Death of Marsha P. Johnson, that's what really said, okay, I need to reach out to them now, because I've been wanting to for a while, and I saw you two on it, and it just reminded me of just the rich history that you lived through, and I wanted to capture it so other people could experience it. So I wanted you to tell each of you to tell us your experience of how Transy House got started. Who started it? What was the impetus? What said we need to do this? We need to create a space for people like us to exist together.
Well, it's a house of about I think it's three or four steps high or levels high. You know,
mm-hmm.
And so,
yep.
There's a lot of space there, and
like a brownstone or something. And
yes, brownstone in Park Slope.
Park Slope, got it.
Yeah, and I think we were on 10th Street or something like 10th and 10th or something. So, you know, I was a little concerned always about people, you know, kind of harassing us as we were living there, but nobody ever seemed to do much of anything. That they maybe didn't notice us, or they just like plowed us into the whole thing. But, you know, so I thought it was a pretty comfortable living situation for someone mm-hmm. that's been living in that area of mm-hmm. Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And people are, you know, there are a lot of people there with different attitudes and different interests and things. So they're not too anxious to like harass people on the street. Mm-hmm. It's more of a middle-class type of culture, you might say.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And you were the homeowner, or you were the one renting
it? I was the homeowner.
You were the homeowner. Yeah. And so at what point, which one of you said, let's just start taking people in? What was the moment that you decided to do that?
Well, it seemed like we were almost always taking somebody in.
Oh, really?
What happened originally is that Rusty bought the house because she wanted a house in Brooklyn and for us to live. And we had a couple of specific friends that we wanted to share the space with. Like, you know, like we had a different model than what involved in mind. What the original idea was an intentional community where people that are already friends and who already choose to live communally with each other are doing that intentionally, but with, you know, mature adult people with agreements as to how the household is to function. And that never really did, except for brief periods at a time, work out quite as we originally intended it. Because, I mean, right off the bat, I was hanging out at Sally's and performing there a lot. And some girl from Sally's would say, I don't have a place to, I just got kicked out of my apartment or whatever. I'm like, well, crash with us until you figure something out. And 10 years later, they're still there. And only the devil knows if they figured anything out or not. They're still there. You know what I mean?
Bit of an unconditional living space.
And I'm like, I don't like living with this person, but I don't have the heart to throw them out. So
would you ever throw anybody out? Like through the, I mean, 13 years and really high risk situations from what I...
Oh yeah, there were times when there really was no alternative.
I would imagine. Yeah. You had to protect yourself as well. You couldn't just protect everybody else.
I mean, we had a person, I'm not going to give names, living with us that just kept pilfering. I mean, pilfering, but it was like, I'm in the shower and I'm reaching where my razor is supposed to be. And no, somebody stole that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm out the door on the way to the subway, reaching in the pocket that I know damn well. I put my subway tokens in and my pocket's empty. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll have to buy more tokens. I go to take the $20 I know I got in my other pocket out, and son of a, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And I put up with it for a while when it was my money and my subway tokens. But then it was things like my weed and my pipe and enough already. I'm not going to have this. Like,
take my money, take my razor, take my subway tokens, touch
I gotta draw
my
the
weed.
Line somewhere.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Jean-Luc Picard put it best. The line is drawn here, this far, no further.
And are you two aware of, I mean, 13 years is a long time. Are you two aware of moments where you actually did do good? Because just so you know, you're heralded and written about and remembered as redirecting a lot of people's lives who would have died on the streets otherwise. And I'm sure some of them still did tragically because of their situations. But, you know, you did do a lot of, you did quite a service for people. Are you aware of any of that? I'll start with Rusty on that.
We were aware of taking people into the house. I mean, giving them space to stay in, and a lot of them were, you know, not with us all the time. They would leave after a couple of weeks or a month or two or something like that. And also in that area, in Park Slope, it's kind of a place where you can move around and know a lot of people and easy to get transportation and everything. So it was a comfortable place to live. Really didn't. It wasn't uncomfortable in terms of, oh boy, we're going to beat the shit out of these, these people that are coming to adulterate in the neighborhood or something like that.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Chelsea?
In 1995, a lot of things changed. But first, I mean, Rusty remembers not being harassed, no trouble. Rusty has way more passing privilege than I do, obviously. I remember that differently. I was starting to think that faggot was my name. Faggot Chelsea Goodwin. I thought I might as well put that on my office door because that's what everybody calls me anyway. You know, get the idea, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And
that was my name too, by the way, in middle school. So I understand.
Well, you know the drill.
I know the drill.
So in 1995, a couple of things happened. One, we had somebody from Sally's living with us. Rusty and I had a terrible argument because the person's boyfriend had just gotten out of jail and was a crackhead, and he was in jail for robbing people. And I was like, no, we don't bring him in. We throw her out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was overruled. Meanwhile, Rusty and I go to Belgium, and in the same hospital with the same doctor in the same week, me one day later than her, we had her sex reassignment surgery because at the time Belgium was a lot cheaper and Europe was a lot more, well, Europe is more advanced. Look at Europe and look at Trump. Tell me who's civilized, who's an advanced civilization, and who were backward chimpanzees who ought to be living in trees flinging their own poo at each other, right? So we get back. And a friend picks me up at the airport to tell me that everything in the house that wasn't nailed down, like the silverware, the jewelry, anything that could be stolen was stolen. And I was like, you know what? This isn't working for us. We can't keep doing this. There are some people, Celia's one of them, and she'll probably see this and she knows who she is, or Marilyn's another one. People whose lives we really did help advance, but who also were good people with good hearts and knew how to take advantage in the positive way, as opposed to the negative way of taking advantage of an opportunity.
Totally.
But, you know, so we were like, going in a different direction. But then I think it was in 95, maybe early 96, I went to the first, the opening conference or whatever, when they founded CLAGS, the Lesbian and Gay Studies thing. Was the first one in New York, and it was all historical and so on. So I went to the thing, and Sylvia Rivera was there, and I knew who she was. I had recently read Duberman's book about Stonewall, but I knew how she was because back in New Jersey, when I was coming out, I was looking for books and stuff about trans people, and I ran into Arthur Evans, Dancing the Gay Lib Blues, which came out in 1971 and had a lot of, that was the original story of Stonewall and Sylvia, mm-hmm. the earliest version, the way it was originally written. Yes, the story did keep changing, but so does the story of King Arthur and Robin Hood and stuff. Legends change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not comfortable with that. I kind of like hard facts, but, you know. So the whole CLAGS conference was very kind of, it was very transphobic. Everything was lesbian and gay. Nobody wants to hear about trans. I don't believe anything in the gay world about that really changed significantly until Obama. Obama had a better attitude about trans people, and I mean Obama personally, not the Democratic Party, not mm-hmm. the gay establishment. Clinton wouldn't listen to anybody but Barney Frank, who is about the most transphobic son of a bee that ever lived. But
what do you think contributes to that? What's the transphobia within the gay community about? Have you ever spoken to anybody and learned where that comes from?
They refuse to believe that we are not them. Somebody is not a trans woman because they're an extreme gay at once that's closeted. We are not them. They are not us. I felt that to be true to who I really am, I needed to transition and I needed to become much more feminine than I was originally. Nobody achieves it. Perfection, but that was the direction that I needed to go in order for me to function as a viable person that could function in the world.
Makes sense to me.
And I don't understand why most of the gay community at that time felt driven to try to look like a cross between Marlon Brando in the movie The Wild One and a Nazi stormtrooper, but they seemed really threatened by anything that might in any way suggest that effeminacy was a viable option, probably because of the way they'd been tortured their own way.
Well, that's the piece that I think is very insightful. That you're representing that fear, right? And that's one thing that's very courageous, again, about the time period you two came out to live as your authentic selves.
I would, however, like to get back to my story because it's key.
Please. Okay,
so you have a bunch of angry gay men who had, or claimed to have, participated in the Stonewall Rebellion. And you had a bunch of very angry lesbians, some of whom were friends of mine, and some of whom were the original TERFs before J.K. Rowling came up on the scene. I mean, the TERF thing goes all the way back to 1974 when Vito Russo, the man for whom the Vito Russo Library is named, had physically kicked Sylvia Rivera karate style to get her off the stage at a pride rally at the behest of an ex-nun turned TERF lesbian feminist named Jean O'Leary. That's 1974 was the year that group of organized crime figures called Heritage of Pride decided to purge all of the drag and trans presence from the pride march. So cut to, it's now 1995, and I'm at CLAGS, and you have the angry lesbians and the angry gay men screaming insults at each other on the stage for the historical commemoration of Stonewall. Mm-hmm. And there's this angry Puerto Rican seagull voice squawking from the floor, and I followed that, and there was Sylvia Rivera, who had been living on the pier and had been homeless and so forth, so I invited her to live with us. I did that in part because it was the right thing to do, because her historical significance as a trans person deserves to be recognized as, I'm not going to be say more, but as much as an icon of transgender people as Christine Jorgensen or Renee Richards or Jan Morris or any of the, you know, whiter upper class trans people that were the first to start having the surgeries and things, as I was lucky and privileged to do, because I caught a lucky break and got together with her. It wasn't like it was readily achievable. I want you to get the picture, though, of the total injustice that as late as the mid-1990s, at the founding of CLAGS, the Gay and Lesbian Studies Program, they still have all the gay men and lesbians coming to blows almost on the stage, fighting about who did or did not do what back in Stonewall in 1969. Sylvia Rivera is not even invited up on the stage to talk about Stonewall when she had as much or more reason than anybody that did. Mm-hmm. But there was still that anti-trans prejudice within the gay and lesbian community as recently as 1995 and 1996. Mm-hmm. I can't emphasize that point enough. Mm-hmm. I invited Sylvia to come live with us because I wanted to and did not only give her a place to live, but access to an office with telephones and printing equipment and computers, and give her the tools she needed to become a functioning activist force again. Mm-hmm. I did that in part because it was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. I did that in part because I knew she was the missing figure that lent legitimacy to the trans demand for our rightful place within the LGBT community. She was my smoking gun, as it were. Mm-hmm. You guys owe us. Mm-hmm. You can't treat us like this. You owe us. Mm-hmm. You know, the propaganda value of that was immense.
So I have a question for you. You're bringing up a lot, and I'm curious about something. When you were saying that there was such prejudice against trans people within the lesbian and gay community, were your allies then heterosexual and other trans people? Or just, I'm curious, like, where did you fit in with your allies?
My allies and friends were mostly trans people of color in places like Sally's and the ball scene that I hung out with, the kind of people that you saw in the movie Paris is Burning. I did a lot of shows with Dorian Corey and Jesse Torres, and I wasn't mm-hmm. in that movie, but all those wonderful people that were mm-hmm. were my friends and my peer group mm-hmm. and the people like, you know, that was my support community right there.
Got it.
That and the downtown goth community.
Oh, interesting. And it was the just downtown, the goth community, regardless of sexuality or gender, it was just the goths.
Gotcha. Right. The downtown goth, the goths accept everybody.
That's so beautiful.
They didn't. The goth doesn't accept you because you're trans, or in spite of you being trans, they accept you because you're another goth, and that's a right. beautiful thing.
Right. That's really nice. That's really nice.
You know. So,
what was your? Who were your allies, Rusty? Where did you find yourself fitting in or getting support?
Where did I get support? I would be going to
your colleagues at Hofstra were nothing but supportive. No.
They were supportive, yeah, in the sense that they said it's okay.
You spend a lot of time at Sally's with me.
Right, at Sally's. And
you were well received in academia, that's for sure.
Academia is like,
That's nice. It interests me because I think there's like the picture when you hear LGBTQ, you know, and now LGBTQI, when you hear that, you get this idea of this big, happy, queer family, but you've had this other experience where there's a lot of segregation within that.
Well, that's true. But, you know, the thing with, in terms of me professionally, after coming out, in a sense, I was just pretty much accepted as being an out person and, you know, a transsexual person. And nobody seemed to pay too much attention to it.
Mm. I mean, support is never what you think it is.
Right.
I was getting plenty of support smoking pot and doing mushrooms with Hell's Angels at Grateful Dead concerts while dressed as Morticia Adams.
Right.
Because, I love that. Because what they saw was another person at a Grateful Dead concert who was expressing themselves as fully as one can. And
that's what interests me. I feel like I truly, you asked me a question before we recorded about, like, you know, essentially, like, Luis, what do we do during these horrible times? That was the essence of the question. And I didn't have an answer, but I just, and I may be naive, but I just believe everyone can find one thing to connect to another human being with. And I get so interested when I speak to people like you to find out, you know, the strange places, like you said, where you found support. That interests me.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like all the support isn't in LGBT space. I don't believe that one's sexuality or even one's gender identity should so define them that I'm a writer, I'm an artist, I'm a musician, I'm also trans. Does being trans influence the way I write or the way I play music or the way I perform comedy on stage at a convention or the way I do radio? I'm sure it influences it, but it's not. I do a goth radio show. There's not enough money in this world that would make me do the trans radio show and talk about nothing but being trans. It would bore me more than it would my audience.
Well, I think that's why I get along with you so well, because I'm very similar. Like I think John Waters is the one that always says it, where he says, like, he likes the people that don't fit in with their own subculture. That's me too. You know, I never quite fit in with the hippies. I never fit in with the intersexuals. I never fit in with the bisexuals. I have friends, you know, who are Republicans, who are straight, who are gay, who are Black, who are Puerto Rican. And not because of any one define. If you put all my friends in a room, they'd hate each other. You know? But it's like, I'm their common bond. So it's nice to talk to people. Is that your experience as well, Rusty, or just Chelsea?
Well, you know, I never had the slightest bit of trouble. I mean, I was on the faculty at Hofstra University, where I was on the faculty. And so I at some point I probably told them, listen, I'm going to transition as a transsexual person. And here's my documents that I put together, and here's what I can do because it's legal to do this, and you're not going to throw me out in the street and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I walked right through it.
Oh, was that standing? Our boss was like, Rusty, it must have been so hard. What can we do to help you? How can we make this easier for you?
Amazing. You have like a halo around you. It's interesting because it's. I also hear that you weren't, like, Chelsea, you know, she's so fringe, like from a mile away, you can feel her aura coming. That's a compliment.
Thank you.
And I feel like you, like when you said earlier about her passing privilege, I wasn't thinking in terms of looks. I was just thinking in terms of energy. Like, Rusty, you have such a very gentle, calm energy that I think just easily fits into situations. Mm-hmm. And Chelsea's just so unapologetically Chelsea. And so, you know, you can't not miss her. And I think that's what's so exciting about her. So I love hearing these differences of your journeys, you know, as you transition. Of course they were different, yeah. Right? Your energies were so different in the world. Mm-hmm.
I think I'm a vessel for some kind of crazy goddess. I really do. I think that was
true. I agree.
There have been times, particularly when I'm stoned listening to your music, when I wonder if it's true of you. And you're certainly some kind of shaman or holy person or something. I call you a guru.
Well, you know, the first time I saw you, I remember being at the merch table and you were looking through merch. And I saw you as a goddess. You know, you had this long braided pigtails and beautiful makeup and a very special dress, and you looked like have you ever seen it's leaving me now, what's that movie, The Mists of Avalon? Do you ever see that?
Yes.
You look just like the. Was it Angelica Houston? Was she the one that was the witch that takes them back to the island?
Yes.
You look just like her.
Thank you. So people keep asking me who would I want to play me in a movie, and I always say Angelica Houston.
Oh, you totally. And that's what I saw right away. I'm like, oh my God, it's one of the Avalon witches.
Totally, I identified with her as Morticia.
Totally, of course you did. So, but I can see you when you say you're a vessel for a goddess. I totally see it. That's what I love about you. It's like a walking deity. It was very special.
Same's true of you, though.
Well, that's very kind. I appreciate.
I'm kind of a deity.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody a while ago. I think it was. You should listen if you don't. There's a podcast called Earth Speak, and I did an interview with her a while ago, and I was talking to her about the first time I ever came upon Wicca and the books about witches and such. And the deity was the first time I felt like, oh, someone that looks like me. You know, there was something that just felt right about it. So I've always identified. I don't believe myself to be one. I appreciate that you see that, but I always identified with one. So that was helpful. So
well, look at Melina. I mean, you know, she's some kind of crazy goddess you play music with.
Who?
Ms. Krieger from
Wrestling. Oh, well, God, I got it. I hear what you said. Absolutely.
I have trouble pronouncing her name, but I know she's a goddess.
Yeah, no, Melora is definitely comes from another
planet. Melora is a goddess. There's no doubt about it.
Another realm, right? So we have
Voltaire
to...
Voltaire says the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Voltaire sees that in Melora. It's there.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that with her. She channels it through her cello.
Oh, you have that hoobajoob too.
Well, so I have a closing question, okay? The question is simply, it comes actually from, there's a photo online with Rusty holding a sign. It says, not fooling anyone, just being who we are. I think it's from the 90s. I think it's in the East Village, actually. I just love that sign, not fooling anyone, just being who we are. It's so beautiful. And it says so much. And so my question for both of you, starting with Rusty, is what if you have any advice or any experiential advice, what would it be to people who are listening who think, I'm really not who I say I am and I don't know how to be who I really am? Like, what's your advice from all your experience?
Well, I think it's always important to be within yourself and to, you know, don't try to trick people into thinking who you are, or what you are, or whatever. I think I've probably mostly always said, oh, I'm transsexual, or I'm going through a transition right now, or something like that. And I just let it go. And nobody ever seems to harass me very much. But the thing is, I have somehow I am able to look the right thing when people see me. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. That's the way it goes. My voice is not, I don't have a bass voice or anything like that. Also,
that helps.
Makes them think, oh, well, this isn't some kind of nut that's going to hit me.
How about for you, Chelsea? What would you say?
That is an interesting question, and I'd answer this differently perhaps if I were talking to somebody other than to Luis here.
Okay.
Because I see parts of myself in you, and I see parts that I see in you in myself. Mm-hmm. That's not true of everybody. I mean, I can see both of us on the same, let's try to do this the most politically correct and like woke way possible, in a Roma caravan in Transylvania or something. You know what I mean, right?
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
And I can so see that.
Easily.
We'd be in two different tents, but we'd both have a crystal ball and some tarot cards. Right.
And a pot that we're always stirring with smoke coming out.
Exactly. And I think that there are people who are different, who are called to be different. I think you and I are who we are because some kind of in my case, I believe it's a goddess, but some sort of a deity I'll ride you, as they say in Santerian Voodooan. And there's an ancient, often angry, very turbulent, very physical, sexual goddess that rides me. I was going to say, I don't mean that quite as dirty as it sounded, but I think I
do. No, I get it. Yeah.
And...
But you do, yes.
But I think I do, yeah.
You do. I think you do, too.
But the thing is, some people get terribly, terribly hurt and suffer a lot. And it does terrible things to them, and they end up becoming violent or crazy, and bad things happen. Mm-hmm. And then there are people like yourself, like myself, like Melora, just picking examples here. I see this a lot with Ryder from the Dust Bowl Fairies, who's become a very dear friend to me. People who you can look in, I can look in someone's eyes and tell this person has been hurt and suffered every bit as much as I have, and maybe a little more. And instead of becoming angry and violent or bitter or crazy or suicidally depressed, it brings out a kindness and opens up a sort of spirituality. And all that pain and all that suffering, and even having taken all of that abuse, is a version of Inanna or Persephone or Osiris, trying to keep the gender balance here, you know, suffering the horrors of the underworld. It's an initiation.
That's right. Beautifully put.
You have had one hell of an initiation, every bit as severe as I have. I can see that in your eyes. And that's really what's at the center of my identity, is this crazy goddess within keeps remodeling me to be who I should be, to be the best vessel I can be for that presence within me.
That's right. Well, you're shedding light on a lot right now, because earlier we were talking about that John Waters quote around not getting along with people in your own subculture, not relating to people in your own subculture. I think when I was thinking of all my friends and how different they are and how they wouldn't necessarily get along with each other, the thing that binds me to them is what you just said. There's been a great deal of suffering and trauma, and they've turned that trauma into wisdom and compassion. And that's like very alchemical. It's magical.
And what I try not to be is that I wish that I could claim credit for this thought. I just agreed with it. Somebody else wrote it. Part of our whole thing with the evangelicals and vice versa is that in coming out, I'm gay, I'm trans, I'm bi, I'm asexual. And believe me, that's a hard one for me. I cannot imagine what that would be like, because I can't even conceive of such a thing. And I know that's what straight people say about being gay or being trans. So I don't mean that in a judgmental way. It's just that I know what it is to be slut-shamed, but I don't know what it is to be discriminated against because you don't want anything.
How interesting, right? Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't know how to relate to that, but the point I'm trying to make, I think, is just as the born-again Christian evangelical people, they say they've had this transformative experience, and then they have to preach it and spread it, and it just like takes over till they no longer have an individual personality. They join that collective. You and I both know people in the lesbian, gay, bi, where the sexual or gender identity becomes such a central focus, it becomes another way of joining another board collective instead of developing as an individual.
Beautifully put.
Best example I can give is a friend of mine that was here recently. It's Thanksgiving. I'm watching the Honeymooners because, you know, it's Thanksgiving and I'm watching the Honeymooners. And My friend from Radical Fairies comes in. Why are you watching this? Is there a gay subtext? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm watching this because these people were comic geniuses and it's funny. I don't know. There is such a thing as art for art's sake sometimes. You know what I mean?
Right, right. You break out of that box. I get that. Yeah, that's nice. I think actually that's the note I want to end on. That's really nice. Thank you too for joining me. It was really great to have you and your wonderfully strange, unusual, beautiful personalities. I'm very, very happy. Thank you, Rusty and Chelsea.
Thank you. I'm glad we finally got to do this. And any excuse to hang out with Luis Mojica is okay by me. I love getting to know you. It's been a wonderful part of my journey.
Oh, thank you. So I hope you enjoyed this little slice of history. If you're a queer person, transgender person, you probably have loved this episode. If you're an old East Villager or you love New York City, you probably adored this episode because these were used to being around. This culture is very familiar. For me, I get homesick of this kind of crude, loving, sophisticated culture that combines the sacred and the profane. And that's one thing I love about Chelsea and Rusty is they really combine the sacred and the profane. And they are unapologetically them. And I'm always inspired by, I always tell people that I don't care what someone believes in. And what I mean by I don't care, I mean, it doesn't affect me. I don't judge them for their beliefs or how they speak or how they live or what they do. I just love when people are authentic. And nothing excites me more or fills my heart up more than sitting with people who are just who they are. And Chelsea always refreshes me. You can find more on Chelsea. You can go to Facebook and type in Chelsea Goodwin, and you can find her radio show, which is called In Goth We Trust. She's really brilliant, and she's great to listen to. She's interviewed me a couple times years ago when I was touring with a band I used to tour with called Rasputina, and then she found my own work, and she started appreciating it, and that's how I found her in my circle. And you can also, if you go to YouTube, you can type in my name, Luis Mojica, followed by the words City Friends. And City Friends is a song I wrote and recorded and released on my last record. And Chelsea makes an appearance right at the end. And it meant a lot to have her in there to take that little snapshot of, queer history, histories of the other. And I appreciate her and Rusty for all their work at trying to un-other people and accept people for who they are and inspire us all with that fearless courage and bravery. Why don't we actually end the show with my song, City Friends? I'd love to leave you with it. I wrote it when I left New York City, and while I was living there, I was kind of mourning all the renovations that were happening so quickly around me. And people like Chelsea and Rusty, people who are so colorful and who were the bedrock of so many social movements, had to leave because it was too expensive. And I remember thinking, I was really sad at the time. I was feeling like angry about it and frustrated, and I was just grieving. Everywhere I walked, I was grieving the East Village and every renovation. And I wrote in the song, I knelt down to pray before eviction eulogies, because every building I walked by had a spirit for me, whether it was attached to a Patti Smith poem or an Ani DeFranco lyric or a Joni Mitchell song or a Leonard Cohen song or a Buffy St. Marie song, all these people I grew up with who were in my blood and my bones, I was seeing the monuments from their lineage being taken down. And then one day I realized, oh, wow, this is like a gift. It's like the sage smoke is being blown out of the city into other places that need it. And it took me to Woodstock, New York. It took Chelsea to I think, Margaretville, the top of a mountain. It takes all these radical, strange, beautiful people who I belong to, the circle I belong to, I'll say, and it puts us places we would never even think of going. So I've come to love that experience in the city of the city becoming gentrified that I had to leave. And the song really explores gentrification of so many things, the heart, a city, the mind, the spirit, relationships, the grief, and the rebirth of so many situations in our lives. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you.
Walking through the city, a small tear drops down. It seems they made a suburb of our wild old town. I think of all the friends who've left and those who've stayed to taste the mountain air or dirt and their own graves. When your friends turn into ghosts and then they haunt you. When your friends become possessed and then they want you. Take up residence inside of your chest, don't you? It's the only way they say they know how to love you. Maybe it's the only way they ever tried to. I done do dropped in like mountain mist on a fern's wet tear. I looked for the proof from words and songs that brought me here. I found train stations, renovations, and broken trees. I knelt down to pray before eviction eulogies, while the best minds of my generation got lost and blinded by the sleek designs of the loan sharks, whose plastic fins never did circle in my heart. Because I know imitation from sincere heart. When your city turns to gold and it won't hold you. When the land you love the most overthrows you. And all your sacred words and dreams become exposed to some spoiled fiend who claimed to love your heart and soul. Then turned your authenticity into style. You know it's bad when tourists dress like native gods, and you have a hard time telling both of them apart. Because it's just too easy to look up and steal the part and trick yourself into the template of that heart. Until your shell rusts over from the stolen sparks.
Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. My question for you is, where do you feel the episode? Take a breath and just notice, what's your body doing right now? Sit with it, let it speak to you, and let whatever comes up, come up. And your only job is to listen, for all the wisdom you need is right inside of you. For more information on my work, including my online courses and healing circles, please visit holisticlifenavigation.com. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook, where I share weekly philosophies and resources to help you release stress and trauma from your body so that you can live a happier life. Thank you so much for joining me. I'll see you next time.